welcome to the Superposition Podcast. We are here in our second week, and Duncan and I are excited to kind of get into things this morning. How you been doing, Duncan?
Good, good. It's been another week of redefining paradigms and rethinking just how to do life while trapped at home. But just to add to that, I'm an introvert, so. While I say that, not much has really changed.
Yeah. So do you like the fact that you're home then? I mean, because you're home for your job a lot of, anyhow, right?
I am.
Yeah.
I am.
Now, though, you might have more family at home, so that actually might be.
It's weird in that sense where I'm not used to having a human presence around me 24/7. I mean, even shopping has radically changed in this process. So I think in that respect, it's very different. But it's in certain respects very different than in others, not so much.
Yeah. Well, I'm binge watching a lot more shows as I'm doing stuff. So I'm somebody I can work while I have something going on the side. So I had all these like shows that I had watched parts of and I hadn't finished them. And now they're all just knocked out. So
that's good. That's a good time for television, but you're one of the reasons why the internet is so slow these days.
That's probably true. It's probably my house exclusively, actually. So between myself and my five-year-old consumes more. I don't even know how he consumes the amount of stuff that he does, but I think he has slowed Disney. He made Disney Plus, slow for probably the nation just by himself this week. So, but it's been pretty amazing. So, definitely things are changing. The first story that I have for today is that I saw that a little while ago, some places, and particularly I saw an article on CNN that was talking about how because of all these changes, it's really disrupted the way people have had to do things with churches. And we've talked about that a little bit in our last podcast. But one of the things that they're finding that's really challenging now is they don't know how to conduct a funeral, and they're trying to be sensitive to this, but they obviously people can't gather. So it's like, it's this really kind of crazy and, in some ways tragic thing. But what I've seen is in the UK, they've actually requested that people cremate folks because they're not able to have the service right away. Wow. And then there's some people that are having live stream services, and they're having live stream services for these funerals. So I don't know about you, but to me that's pretty rough, right? Like how right now we're not even, I mean, we have this stay at home order, right, in Florida. So it's like, I'm not sure how you'd even do that at this point. And, to help people to grieve, obviously when we have funerals, they're for the folks who are still present, but trying to figure out what that would look like and how that would work is a real challenge. And so, I don't know. It's been interesting to see how that works. I mean, what do you think about that kind of, about moving to online like that?
Well, that's, I mean, that's such a radical shift in how we think and how we do things. And I think it's one of the last things that we would expect to do that. I think, when we think about family and really connecting on a relational, emotional level with someone and the life of someone, the last thing you want to do is not be there. But it is such a fascinating concept in thinking, that you can still facilitate that process digitally, and you can pull people from all around the world into that emotive expression. But I think it is going to have a profound effect on people as they have to navigate through those sorts of scenarios. I think it reemphasizes just the value of human interaction, the value of being physically present. A similar story in that vein that I also stumbled upon was similar challenge. I think it was in the UK, but I can't recall now, where they said people are critically ill in hospitals, and they're not allowing people to be there to say goodbye. I'm seeing similar situations in the US right now. I read on one of my social media feeds, a friend posting that his wife is giving birth and he can't be there. Just the challenge. And some of these things, you know, technology can be used in the context of the UK of saying goodbye to parents and family members. They're using live streams for that. But just how disruptive this is, and maybe reemphasizing just how, you know, technology is incredible, but the way we've been conditioned, it's still such a far cry.
And is it still limited in so many ways, right? Like, so even in a virtual context, we have kind of the uncanny valley, you know, right, element, where if you make a different avatar made for me right now, and the first one was just terrifying, right? and so you kind of go through this like, yeah, like, you know, I know I'm a little self-conscious, but that does not look like me at all, right? And so so you're looking at stuff like that, and until we're able to actually feel like we're in each other's presence, you know, we're kind of using baby step technology, right? Like, right. And so, you know, theologically, I've thought about if all tech is God's, you know, divine technology, if everything we experience in the world is divine technology, then does that mean we are kind of just on the very front end? And we have these kind of like baby steps effectively. And right now, what we think is really advanced technology is just so minuscule because it's not even close to our present reality. And we're not able to actually, you know, fully create. And I think, I think it's interesting. The concern I would have with this is, one, I think it's better that they're doing some live stream stuff. If you're going to do something digitally, like in the last podcast, I talked about how I for worship, I don't even think actually live stream is the best thing for most churches. But actually in this context, I think it's better because it does create an event, like a specified event that's happening, and it's real. And so there's able to be some emotion in that. I don't know if people are able, like, it'd be interesting to know if anybody's done like a Zoom call version of this where people do eulogies, or because you can have a lot of people in Zoom. So it'd be right. interesting to know if there's some where people can kind of corporately mourn. But I wonder a little bit if, you know, the digitalization of this takes away some of the emotion of it. I wonder if it kind of numbs us a little bit to the fact that this has happened, and whether we actually process in the same way. I've often wondered when a funeral is happening, people have so many different kinds of grief that they deal with. And I've often wondered if when the funeral is happening, looking at the people who are most immediate to the family, people have radically different reactions to that. And sometimes people aren't processing that at all. And sometimes, you know, they're fully like immersed in it right then. And, you know, for the folks who don't process it, sometimes they're processing it 6 months later, right? And so I wonder what the impact of the tech is on that. I have no idea. I don't know that we'll know until more of them are done that way. You know, but I wonder if, you know, I've really been, one of the things I've been concerned about is, you know, we certainly need to quarantine and self-isolate. On the flip side of that, I also wonder what the status of people's mental health is going to be 3 months into this, because there's if folks aren't like you, where they're used to working at home, you know what I mean? Like, because it's a real shift to work from home. And I've worked from home in prior circumstances. But, you know, like my wife last week was really having a challenge with that shift. And it's adaptive thing to be able to go, wait, what is happening to me right now? And I can't interact with. And so if your first interaction of that, like if you were on the front end of the pandemic and you got stay-at-home orders, and then you had a family member die, or right before a family member die, you have all that stuff cumulatively thrown on top of it. You know what I mean? And boy, I don't know how that's going to, I don't know how that's going to play for people. I almost wonder then, the other thing is if you postpone these, so not talking about coronavirus, like put coronavirus aside, there's like 7,000 deaths in the US a day. So just for other reasons, more than that, actually. So, you know, if you postpone all those funerals for however long, then imagine what that's going to look like. Like, it's then you have all of a sudden, it's like you have this very complicated grief process that's happening. And all these people, I wonder if it'll just be like, oh, yeah, another funeral today. Oh, yeah, another funeral today, to a point where it almost minimizes other people's grief. They feel disenfranchised in their grief at that point. So I think this is a super, like, complicated thing. I think it's really important for people as they're talking about how they're doing to like really recognize the fact that we're all dealing with different levels of grief and how are we going to process that. And there's some ways that digitally it's maybe not the most effective thing right now for us, and so, you know, figuring out how we can help each other in that is really important. You can't hug people, right? You can't do the things you would normally do. You wouldn't, I mean, now it's like you're afraid to send flowers to people because you don't want to send them, you know what I mean? Like, so it's like the things you would do to show you care aren't in the same way. So you can call and you can talk, but we have, it's been more than just isolation in our house. It's sensory isolation in some ways too. And so
absolutely,
really, really tough thing. So, anyhow.
Wow. Yeah, no, I think we're going to rediscover how we do so many things in this season. And I think a part of that would also challenge why we do what we do.
Right.
You know, when you brought up the conversation about funerals going digital or being forced to be a digital experience because of quarantine and self-isolation and you know, creating social distance, it immediately made me just reevaluate why for me a funeral is important and why it's important to have that, the spiritual significance, the psychological, emotional significance of that. And this might be an opportunity for us to have some conversations around that to have a deeper understanding as to, you know, why we do it the way we do and what the alternatives to that could look like. And certainly
I think that's really important. I think that is a positive insofar as I would say kind of across the board, churches do not do a good job of explaining why we do what we do. There are so many people that come into a church, for example, and if the church reads a creed, nobody talks about why are we reading this creed? You know, let's just say the Apostles' Creed for the 9 millionth time, and we have no reason why. You know what I mean? We have no understanding of why. So let's say the Lord's Prayer again. You know what I mean? We did a mission trip in Jamaica once, and we went to a school, and we led a prayer, and the kids, like 600 kids that we were teaching, they all said the Lord's Prayer together, and it sounded like the most robotic thing I've ever heard in my life. And I realized in that moment saying the prayer that they were doing it not because they were getting something out of it. They were doing it because they were in school, and this was kind of the robotic right response, you know? And so the question is when we grieve, do we do that? Like, do we just, after a while, we just kind of go into like our, you know, robot selves and we don't process that stuff. And then eventually that just piles up, you know what I mean? And so figuring out how to lament and, you know, be effective in that is I think a really important thing. You know, having those conversations is important because it seems like we're going to have more and more of that as we're, you know, trapped effectively in our homes for a while. And so, and as we learn more about, you know, what's happening in our world that none of us, at least in this lifetime, have experienced yet.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's crazy, right? I mean, it's just crazy. Well, now that I've brought us in on the happiest note on...
It can only get better from here.
It'll only go up. Like I got another story later that's way, way better than this. So
okay. All right. Thank you. All right. Thank you, all right, Christopher.
What do you got?
Oh goodness, man. Hold on.
Let me get my Let me wipe my tears now and
take that off. Yeah. So on a slightly better note,
just slightly.
I want to talk about something that I found or rediscovered recently, and it's really a fascinating concept of using technology and the computers that everybody at home has or at work has, and using the average individual's computer to help solve real complex issues. And so there is this technology developed by the University of Washington and Berkeley in distributing large sets of computational problems across a vast network to try and solve a bigger problem. So they would take a big challenge. Initially, this was developed to crunch interstellar computations, finding other worlds, finding life beyond the stars. And
I think Matthew McConaughey. Yeah. 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 Good.
he played a role in that.
Yeah.
So they built this technology because they realized to build a supercomputer to crunch this and to do this would just be unfeasible, or infeasible. It would be too expensive. It would take too long. It just wouldn't work. So they built this tool called Folding at Home. It's a piece of software. And there are many different variants of this type of tool. Folding at Home, and the other one is Rosetta at Home, the ones that I specifically looked at and used. And what these do basically is they take a really complex problem, they break it into thousands of different pieces, they send it to people to compute. And then on your computer, you go ahead and you try solve the problem, and it uses your CPU or your graphics processor. And within a couple of hours, you've solved the problem, it sends it back, and then the system brings it all together. What's fascinating around this, and why it's, I think, very relevant right now, is this, as the system was used for interstellar computational issues, it has shifted over the last couple of years to try and solve issues for cancer, Alzheimer's, dementia, Parkinson's, and so forth, specifically the Rosetta at Home project. And in the last 2 to 3 weeks, they've shifted a lot of their resources to solving issues for Corona. So in essence, what this does, specifically as it relates to Corona is, or COVID-19, is it breaks up all the different possible ways that the protein of the virus could react in different environments, be it variants in temperature, variants in pH levels. And just to say, I am not a biologist or a virologist. I'm dangerously aware of how little I know. But from what I read, it tries to understand the reaction of the protein of the virus in certain environments. And what it then does is when it sends different variations of what the protein could function in, it sends it to different computers, and your computer crunches the problem and sends it back. Why this is a relevant conversation above and beyond coronavirus and above and beyond what's happening in the world now is the fact that in the last 3 weeks, so many people have picked up this piece of software that if you compared the top 500 supercomputers in the world and you summed their computational power, this distributed network is more powerful than the top 500 combined.
Wow.
So as humanity coming together to try and solve this problem, using everyday computers, using your MacBook or your desktop computer, we've been able to exceed what the top 500 commercial supercomputers combined can do by just giving a little bit of extra resources on your computer. So I found this really fascinating, this idea of making available the resource that you have for your on your computer or your your MacBook or laptop, and really affecting change. At this point, we've seen quite a bit of research come out of this initiative on COVID-19, and similarly on cancer research, Alzheimer's research, and dementia research in the past. Just how incredible.
Yeah, that's crazy. I mean, so my question is this how the singularity starts? Or like, so, certainly like to be able to use this, but I would have questions like, so how does this impact somebody's computer long-term? Like, does it diminish your computer's life?
That's an excellent question. And it does. To some degree, specifically when you do graphics computational work, because your graphics card, as I understand it, has a limited lifetime. Everything on your computer has a limited lifetime. The more you use it, the more the shorter it'll live.
Yeah.
You have X number of computational hours on that. But really, in the greater scheme of things, it's not going to dramatically reduce it.
I'm assuming you have to be hooked up live to the internet to be doing this, right?
Yeah. So you connect to the internet, you run the application, and really only at certain points in time, it communicates with the internet.
Right.
But
it's not going to mess your Netflix flow up.
No. So that's actually,
that probably matters to people right now. Seriously. You know, if it's like, hey, we're going to save the world, or my 5-year-old's going to watch Disney Plus. There's some people right now that, you know, they're definitely worried about whether their kid is going to keep watching TV or not.
Survival is based on, on this. Right.
But the computational power is crazy because, not even half of the people in the world are online yet. So if you start thinking about, 10 years from now or 20 years from now, and increasingly people are able to, more and more people get online. And now it's like more and more people have multiple computers, right? So it's like, I've heard comedians joke about, it's like they have a computer that they used to use for this task and for that task, and now they just have a stack of computers laying around their house. And it is kind of like that. It's like you have old phones or, and people hold on. I don't know if you have this, but I have like a box of cables that that I have, right? And there's cables in there. I'm not even sure I know what they go to anymore. You know what I mean? But I'm still holding on to it, right?
You never know.
But it's fascinating to think that kind of what the combined computational power can do. Now my question becomes, who determines what these computers work on? And the more common this becomes, do people get to vote on what they think are the bigger problems that get to, Like, is it something like everybody says, well, you know what, we actually want to work on cancer research as opposed to, or we want to dramatically improve life expectancy. So I want my computers to work on that. You know what I mean?
So you can do that.
Oh, okay. All right, good.
As a contributor to the network, you can decide which project you want to support in the process. And it's interesting. Folding at home is so, just to talk about these two projects, there's hundreds of them, but folding at home specifically looks at doing the actual molecular protein folding using computational power on your machine, while Rosetta at home just verifies a fold to make sure that it is logical, that it makes sense. And so Rosetta at home, or folding at home, They had a problem about 2 weeks ago where they didn't have projects to give to people because the network had exploded so much that the work log was empty. So, talking about, how do you prioritize? There was nothing left. So many people had joined that there weren't any projects to
contribute. Wow.
It's insane. And that's not a usual problem. I don't think that's ever happened prior to this.
So it's interesting because if they're focusing on those issues, I wonder how many medical issues can be addressed exponentially more quickly, and what that would what that would mean for people, right? Because it's like, you know, we've had these supercomputers that have found several different ways to treat cancer now that humans throughout our whole history haven't figured out. But once the data presets were put in and they were essentially tell the computer, you know, and I'm obviously simplifying this, but once they tell the computer what it's looking for, then it can do these, you know, exponential calculations so much faster. So if this allows that to speed that up, but then do it to scale on multiple issues at once, I mean, you could actually see if people get into this and start using it, or if there actually becomes almost like it'd be fascinating to see if like major corporations, when they're not using their computers, if it became like a movement to say, well, we all do X, you know what I mean? And, you know, whatever the organization is, you know, banking or whatever, and they say all of our computers, when they're not being used, are being used for this purpose, you know, and that becomes almost like their part of their nonprofit work, right? They're sure. They're using their equipment for the betterment of humanity in that way. That's a really fascinating direction that could go.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm curious to see organizations, you know, start doing that. I haven't seen that really yet. It's such a rare thing at this point. But what I've done, so I run a and own an agency that does web development and web hosting and a whole host of other things. But specifically on the web hosting component, I oversee a couple of servers in the United States, and the nature of what we do with those servers means that they're very memory intensive, but not CPU intensive. And so we've started doing that. We've committed 50% of our CPU resources on these machines toward trying to find solutions for or understanding the protein structure of COVID-19, because, you know, firstly, as everyone else, we'd like this to be resolved as quickly as possible. But second, we have resources, and if we're not going to commit them to this, they're going to be idle. So for us, it just makes sense on the machine I'm on right now, where, you know, I'm talking into, and my laptop, I have the software installed as well. And the moment my computer is idle for 5 minutes, it starts processing through this again. So it's going to be interesting, just coming back to your point, to see how many organizations see this as a corporate social responsibility that they can, you know, leverage the millions of dollars that they've laid out in terms of hardware that very often sits idle toward creating.
So let me ask, and maybe you know, and maybe you don't know, but so the folks who put this together right now, who are the people behind it?
There's a couple of different institutions behind it. The client itself, the one that I'm using at least, is made by Berkeley.
Okay.
I can actually quickly pull that up.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I mean, part of it would be is people would start to wonder like, well, okay, so is somebody going to profit off of this in a way? You know what I mean? Where yeah, they're helping to fix something, but then they develop a monopoly, right? So you've seen some of these folks who have, you know, found drugs that help so and so do whatever, and then, you know, it's like big pharma type mentality. They, you know, they overcharge or gouge people on the pricing for it, and so interesting to see how they do that. And I know a lot of universities, for example, have really moved towards creating sustainability by leveraging their research labs to create products that actually make money. You know what I mean? And some of those they keep in the nonprofit, and some of them they spend them out in the for-profit. And so just kind of a fascinating thing for people to be thinking about, like, because it may not only be like, hey, people want to do this, but again, it may not just be, hey, I want to vote for this project or that project. And maybe people want to start supporting specific, you know what I mean? And that becomes really interesting, because all of a sudden those things can get politicized pretty quickly, I would imagine, right?
Sure.
It'd be cool if there was, and this is where it would be interesting for me to see the church get into these kind of fields, and, you know, and and churches that have kind of the resources. Now, I know this is like experimental stuff, right? That you have to get way into it down the road, but churches start kind of leaning in those directions to say, well, how are we going to be engaged? Not to say that they're trying to be the scientists, to say, how do we have some kind of ethics board where we can help to encourage people to come alongside projects to know there's some kind of ethical standard, you know, being implemented with the data that we're helping to create, because I could see churches, this would be like, particularly in this time, a lot of churches don't know what to do missionally, right? So their worship and their mission have kind of all become one thing. And now there's an opportunity with something like this, where actually it's like, well, everybody at home could do their part to help fix, you know what I mean? And those kind of missions could be like, hey, let's use the common stuff that we're already using to, you know, help better the world. A real sustainability potentially in that if we kind of get in that mentality. But
yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think there's a lot of avenues for people to get involved, for the church to get involved, the corporate church, the big C church. But just to answer the initial leading question to that, I think in terms of monopolizing this, in terms of abusing this, you know, even going that far, it's at this point, it's open to researchers to submit stuff. And there's multiple projects. So if you're not happy with what Rosetta at Home is doing, you can join one of the other 100-plus projects that do similar work.
I like that universities are doing it. It's not to say that universities aren't big businesses, but the reality is they do have the resources, and they are training people who will go out and create entrepreneurial opportunities. So I think that's good. You know, it's a little easier to get behind, I think, a university doing it than a mega corporation, quite frankly. And people seem to have, whether it's a result of their, you know, college football or basketball, you know, ambitions or support, they do seem to have loyalty to their academic institutions that they went to. So particularly big schools that do this kind of work. So that's interesting to see. Well, hey, I have something that's far less grim than my first article, and we don't have to worry about it creating any kind of singularity opportunities.
Thank goodness.
There's no, I don't know. You might be able to figure out some kind of ethical issue on this, but I saw that the Dallas News, they put that in Arlington, there's a church that is really concerned that their Easter egg hunt this year has been canceled. So, you know, I don't know if the churches you've gone to have done Easter egg hunts in the past. Is when you're in South Africa, was that a big, or Easter eggs a big thing in South Africa?
They were. Yeah, the more I'm starting to learn about American culture, there are differences, but it was a big thing. Yes.
So what, can you tell me a difference?
So instead of real eggs, we would have these just chocolate eggs that my parents would buy at the store in boxes of 100.
Yeah, okay.
And
would you hide those?
They would hide them.
Yeah, well, you know we don't hide real eggs, right?
Oh, okay.
No.
Okay.
We're not like, wow. Yeah. I mean, because think about the aftermath if you miss some, like a couple weeks in and it's like your backyard smelling like terrible, or the church grounds are like, what is that smell?
Yeah, I didn't think about that. Yeah.
Yeah. No. We use plastic eggs, but it's actually like a pretty big to do because, you know, they'll like get like, churches I've been to a couple bigger churches, and so we do stuff in the like local park, and we literally have to have like heats for kids, right? Because there's so many kids come if you advertise for these things.
Yeah.
And like I've been at them where they've gone really well, and I've been at Easter egg hunts where they go very poorly. I mean, they look kind of like Lord of the Flies, and you know, I mean, it's like they're kids crying. It's like Toddler Fight Club. You know, it just like, it, you know, and sometimes kids don't get an egg if too many kids show up. So then, you know, I mean, there's all sorts of like good old fashioned church drama involved. It's it's like a church league softball. There's always a fist fight somewhere in the midst of it. Right. So with all hitting each other with all our Christian love. So, so this church is concerned about that. They can't have their Easter egg hunt. And so what they decided to do is Tate Springs Baptist Church. They came up with an idea to try to figure out how to virtually do one. And so they are going to have Easter egg hunt in Minecraft. So they have created it in Minecraft, and they're gonna launch it. So my question would be, so there's you know, not, I wouldn't say a ton, but there are, you know, are some people doing video game ministries out there. My question would be, are we going to see more and more of this as people are online? Obviously, streaming platforms are huge, right? And and like I think 11 million plus people go to Twitch a day. It's probably more than that now, and so just tons and tons of people go. But you know, our church is going to start leaning into this more and more. And the larger question is how do you focus on what you're going to do at that point? Because like, you know, how many of your kids know or play Minecraft, right? It is kind of a targeted audience at that point. It's not like, I mean, even when my kid, you know, my son was little, like he was tiny and you could stick him right in front of an egg and he picks it up and he gets the concept, right? But, you know, if they're super little, they're not going to be on Minecraft. And then, and then, you know, and thank goodness we didn't give him real eggs or as a, that would have
Amen.
Dude, I love it.
I didn't know.
That's awesome. That's what this show's all about, right? So that's so
oh my goodness.
It's epic. So awesome.
Just to say, it's bad. I'm glad to hear that now because I
you were really concerned. You're like, man, Americans are really strange. I mean,
yeah. So at least I'm feeling a little bit more reconciled with the culture after.
Yeah. Good. Yeah, but even a chocolate egg. Like, if you were to put chocolate eggs and hide them all over the place, that they could just be a puddle of chocolate in Florida, right? That wouldn't necessarily always work either. But but you know, so they're gonna do this Minecraft thing. So I wonder if this is more and more going to become kind of the norm. Like, are we going to see more? And I'm thinking about right now putting together like a fellowship group of just gaming for people who are at my church. And just as there's people who want a game, we just get on and play whatever. You know what I mean? And do that. And but that becomes interesting because it brings up all sorts of ethics, right? Mm-hmm. Like, how do you keep kids safe in Minecraft, right? And so, like, I know I've heard of numerous kids programs now that they've done stuff on Zoom and they've got hacked and inappropriate stuff has been put up in front of kids because people didn't know how to manage, kind of Zoom in a way where they can avoid that. So with video games, you know, even if you get on Fortnite, you know, you jump in a party with somebody, there's things I don't want my little kid hearing, right? And I don't want them engaged with. And so really figuring out the quality control of that is going to be an interesting process. So I don't know.
I think the challenge with that is, you know, if you think about physical, social engagement in, forgive me for saying this, but the real world, we've become... I think we infer so much in terms of how we perceive the world and navigate the world and think about personal safety, emotional safety. And it's easy to apply certain principles all the way through. So the way you think about your kid in a shopping mall is the same you would, or very similar to how you would think in a park, you know, out with friends at a restaurant. It all applies really well, and suddenly you sit with the same risks and threats in the digital world, but you perceive it in a very different way because of the fact that it's disconnected. You just don't make that connect. And so I think for parents, I think for friends and peers, we are going to radically come to understand, I think, the risks that are pervasive online. that are pervasive in the digital world, and they're very much the same, if not more dangerous, because you don't have the same level of oversight or visibility as to what's happening. So I think it's going to be a really interesting season, but it is a double-edged scenario, because I think it's beautiful in that we're going to have virtual worlds, digital worlds for people to come together and to have fellowship and have friendship and have meaningful conversations and have fun in a world that is fantastical and
right.
beautiful and just something else, such a, in many respects, a divine overflow of creativity. So I think this is great. I mean, when you mentioned this, I think that's awesome. I would love to join something similar to that in a community of people that I know, to be actively involved in celebrating Easter with others in a very whimsical way. And just to add to this in a very personal manner, it's funny, this is not because of coronavirus, but my best friend growing up recently moved to the Netherlands. Not that that matters, because he would have been in South Africa anyway, but we have this distance between us. And we used to speak very frequently when we were in the same country. And now, because we're in a different time zone and a different continent, it's challenging. So what we've tried to do is to set up an hour a week where we play a video game together and just socialize. So we have a conversation, we catch up on what's happening in our lives, in his relationship with his wife, in my relationship with my wife, the challenges we see living in different countries, and just life, right? But we do that over a shared experience of you know, doing something in a digital virtual game environment. So I think that's beautiful. I think as a society, we're going to be forced to discover something.
I wonder if it requires us to have a little more grace with one another too, right? Because like, look, your kid's gonna, you know, hear something or get exposed to something that, you know, maybe they shouldn't, or you don't want them to, you know, and maybe that's, you know, and I heard we went to Dollywood. I don't know if you know what Dollywood is, amusement park.
About it.
Yeah. And so we went to Dollywood. It's a pretty family friendly place, right? And we went to, Dollywood's got a water park. I don't know if it's still something different. Yeah, it's awesome. And it was great because my then 4-year old could ride a lot of those rides with us, or ride rides by himself, the water rides.
Yeah.
And we went by one of the big rides, like one of the, you know, the, I don't know what they called it, but it was just like the straight drop water slide, you know, uh-huh. the ones where people are pulling their shorts down when they get to the bottom. And there was, you get a little beat up on those, right? It's like being on an old wooden roller coaster, cause you're kind of banging against the walls. And a kid came down and was, you know, like, I don't know, scuffed his knee or did something. And I heard this like Southern mom, you know, say, you know, suck it up, rub some dirt on it, I'm going to get a slushie, you know, like, and it was kind of like, there was a little bit of that, like, you know what, like, get over it. And I just think, like, as a kid, you know, we had a lot of that stuff running around as a kid in the 80s, like you'd fall on your bike or you'd come home and you'd cry about something or whatever. And your parents would be like, yeah, all right, it's a little blood, like, calm down. You know what I mean? I think there's a digital version of that, right? Where there's some of that stuff where it's like life is going to seep in, and where we're going to go, we're going to have, you know, I don't know what it is, rub some pixels on that, you know, and suck it up. But there is some kind of version of that where it's like, yeah, well, that's unfortunate. We didn't want that to happen. You know what I mean? But, but life's going to go on, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And you're going to see a lot more of that in life anyhow. And then as we go, we try to figure out, well, how do we create, you know, the environment so that it's the most helpful for people as we're going. But it takes away a little bit of the bubble wrap that we've wrapped all the way around ourselves, you know? And so,
yeah.
And maybe that's why it's scary, but it's also why it's exciting too, you know, and to figure out, you know, how are we going to be in that process? So
I think just on that, you know, the it's such a fine balance. And absolutely, I think people need to have grace, and people, I think, are afraid of understanding where to have grace in this process. and realizing that, you know, it's life. Life is going to happen. You know, you're going to, your kid is going to be exposed to someone saying something in a Minecraft server that, you know, might not be 100% aligned with how you think or feel about things. But that also happens on the playground, at school, you know, in friend groups, in conversations, text messages, and phone calls. So, you know, and I think we've become...
It doesn't mean that Minecraft is, you know, should be demonized because of that. No. It just maybe gives us a little bit more insight as to actually what our kids face. You know, like my son would come home and say, you know, so-and-so's mean to me, you know? And so you ask him about that. You're also only getting one side of that story, right? Sure. Like, and you find out, they weren't the only ones mean to people, you know? And so it's like, well, how do you balance that with your child to say, okay, so how are they acting? And then how are you responding? Right. And so us kind of learning our personal responsibility in that and our responsibility as parents or as caretakers of other people, I think it's you know, really important that we kind of work through those things. But it's good for me to see, like, hey, these are folks that are saying we're going to try something different. And we're gonna make a concerted effort to try something that we see that our kids are doing anyhow. They're playing Minecraft anyhow, and they probably have some culture of Minecraft anyhow. And so to say, hey, we're gonna do that. And then I want just think about the logistics of setting that up, right? Sure. Like, so now you have some church person who might not know anything about Minecraft, and they gotta kind of figure that out. And so this could be the lamest, you know, seeing how a lot of Christians use technology, could be the lamest Easter egg hunt ever. It could be terrible. Who knows?
They might use real eggs for all we know.
They might use real eggs. That's right. Yeah. So, they're live streaming real eggs. But the opportunity there is obviously is, hey, let's get those kids engaged in ministry in a way where, you know, they're building the worlds or hiding the eggs or, you know, doing whatever. And so good stuff. That's well, great. Hey, I think this time has just gone by super quick, but I think there doesn't seem to be any lack of stuff to talk about in our rapidly developing technological world. Next week we'll pick it back up and go on to the next thing. Sound like a plan?
If we are still here, I think that's a good plan.
Let's hope so. As a public service announcement, do not put real eggs in your kids' Easter baskets. Specifically in your yard. Yeah. If you live in an apartment, don't hide them in your house. That could be bad in quarantine long term.
Yeah. Protect the space you have.
That's right. If you learned one thing out of this podcast today. So anyhow. All right, everybody. Well, have a great week, and we'll be on next week. Take care.